Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to present two talks today. The reason is that, so as I said, there will be two parts, and it will be in the theories of telling authors about their work, both parts. So the first part is evidence builds on the work by Massimo and Boris Reimann on infotaxis. So I will discuss evidence that even small creatures such as C. elegans can implement and approximate a Bayesian calculation such as infotaxis. And the second part will be related to, will build on the work by Alex Kulakov and Dmitry Lindberg on the geometry of the olfactory space. So with the first part is, this was a fascinating paper of following up. We spent 5 years following up on this. But the intriguing hypothesis is that, and the observation was that in dilute environments, and the data that I will be describing is actually in zero order and concentration, so in the limit. But how do animals navigate in turbulent flows? And in this example trajectory, the source is here, and on average, it's emitting a concentration by diffusion, but there are fluctuations due to turbulence, and there is a low probability of detection events. So there are two opportunities. One can, a searcher starts here, and it can estimate the gradient, but in order to estimate the gradient, one has to wait for a long time to have a reliable estimate of the gradient. And in fact, what Massimo and colleagues proposed, that one can at each step estimate how much uncertainty will be reduced if I make different steps. So for a searcher that is local in the olfactory search, it can make a step forward, step back, and steps to the side. And for each step we project, here is my current estimate of the source location. Based on this probability distribution, I estimate what's the probability that I will detect an odorant molecule at the next step. If I do detect this odorant molecule, how much it will narrow my estimate of how much better I will be able to localize the search, and so on for each step, for each of the possible, and then we will choose that step that gives us most information or narrows down the prior in the best possible way. Did I do an accurate job? So, and then of course it requires a model of the environment, because it can be. This is an example of the trajectory without wind. There's an example of trajectory with wind. And it was fascinating that it, the infotaxis trajectory exhibit many strategies, such as the animals do, such as casting to find the plume and other features. And close to the source, the infotaxis converges to the chemotaxis. So this is one argument, yes?
Sorry, I just want to understand something basic. Every step has the same length, and the searcher can just choose the direction, is that the...
Yeah, so one of the parameters, and it will relate to my next slide, but one of the parameters is what are the movements that the searcher can make. This is one of the setups of the problem. And what is interesting, and what I'm hoping to address, or maybe also in the future, if we believe in this strategy, then depending on what kind of moves the searcher can make, it will lead to different search strategies. So in this case, it's a local search, and they can do only... So one can imagine that it can think two steps ahead, like in chess, and then how much better it will get. And it all depends on the kind of control, investment in the control and projections. So that was one motivating example. And then following up on Mitya's question, there is another study, which to my mind is similar, but in this case with eye movements. So it's also a search. And They didn't talk about information, but they talked about literally the peak, the estimated peak of the target location, but also did the same Bayesian calculation. So it's a visual system, and now we can make different eye movements at different, they don't have to be adjacent. But there is some similarity with the olfactory search. For example, this is the first place where a person looks, and because they didn't see the target, and the visual system is has higher acuity in the center compared to the periphery, then that suppresses the probability that the target is nearby. Then they looked here, so this, they didn't find the search, and then they made another saccade, and then finally found the source, the target, after three saccades. So it's essentially the same, to my mind, similar algorithm. And one can use different measures. It can be entropy, as the case of infotaxis, or it can be, in this case, they just use the peak. And it was interesting that the same type of algorithm could reproduce some features of the human eye movement, such as illumination saccades, where the person doesn't look at the target until they're fairly certain the target is there, but they can look at other locations that eliminate various possibilities. So more globally, it's a model for decision making. If I'm trying to think of how to achieve a goal, maybe I don't have to run towards that goal immediately. I can make various steps in order to help me gain information about how to achieve that goal. So that's the motivating example, and two examples, and we decided to test whether this applies to C. elegans. So C. elegans have been mentioned a number of times before in this workshop. So the C. elegans, how C. elegans search for food, so it's of course a similar problem to how ants search for food, and in general a small animal has to search a large area which is 1,000 times their body size. So how do they do it? And so previous work has shown that so C. elegans eat bacteria, and when they crawl around on a plate that is full of bacteria, they make they're happy here, lots of turns. Then if they're transferred on a different plate with no food, then they initially make lots of turns, but then after a while they give up and go search elsewhere. So the question is whether one can model this transition with infotaxis. One can also model it with chemotaxis, as I've discussed, and we will discuss different predictions. So, and that's an example of real trajectories, a patch of food, C. elegans, local search, and then the more global search. So one example first in the model. So we assume that the searcher has some prior. So now it is a solution to the infotaxis problem without any odorant. So the searcher expects to find any odorants, but actually all there is a prior. And this is a starting location. And it turns out that the maximally informative search, so we are solving the infotaxis solution, it also exhibits a transition between a local and global search. So the searcher initially goes towards the maximum of this probability and then erodes it and finally goes to the boundary. And the reason that happens is because in the model we set initial probability that the source is here to very close to 1, but not exactly 1. So the deviation of, say, 10 to the minus 10. But after a while, the searcher erodes this probability and builds up on the probability that the source is elsewhere. And it turns out that this transition from local to global search corresponds to this transition in the probability.
I'm sorry, and the worm is not allowed to learn that using good times. And
this is a model. This is for now. I will compare it with worms. So the worms, what's the question about the worms? So there will be learning. So one thing that one of the predictions, so I'm starting to give my talk in a slightly different order, but that's okay. One of the predictions of the infotaxis is that the probability distribution matters. So one of the predictions is that if the worms expect a big patch or a small patch, the trajectory should be different. And that's one of the what was verified. And one can then test experimentally how long does it take for the worms to learn this probability distribution.
Excuse me, when you say that worm or agent, not probability distribution, is actually long XY map of it, or just a memory of the previous step, because this is very different computational tasks.
Yes, yes, so I can give all of my talk at once. And so we will discuss about how can it be implemented neurally, what it learns, and how, I mean, you know, the bottom line, I don't think it fully implements the infinite access solution, but it can approximate it, and that approximation works well.
That's about, in the model, you are
in the reality, that this is what I think, so this is the synopsis. So there's a model, so right now the model says, this is my prior, and initially we model it as a Gaussian, and the searcher has also some parameters about how fast the orders diffuse. And then using these parameters, you solve this equation. And you find there is a transition. And you can model various aspects of that transition. That's a model.
I'll formulate one thing. The agent knows the XY distribution of the priors.
Yes, so that's a big assumption. So the question is, so in order to do this calculation, we assume full knowledge to the mental map, probability distribution P of X, Y.
Okay.
It knows everything about the diffusion, everything is correct, and then,
sure.
Yes. So, and then, you know, there are other follow-up papers which ask what happens when what search strategy would be robust to errors about the environment, such as diffusion molecules.
Can I just ask one last thing, which is actually about this slide,
okay.
Not something later in your talk. So in this case, in this case, they're updating their map, but they're not getting any food, right? So
yes.
That's why they end up leaving, right? Is that they keep updating this prior.
Right. So what happens is, I don't have this slide here, but this is initial color shows the initial probability distribution. And then as they go, they sort of erode this probability distribution, and then it becomes patchy. And then when the integral of that probability distribution is close to zero, this is when they leave.
Oh, so it's a prior, right?
What?
So
it's a prior.
Okay.
It's a prior, yeah. So. So one can test, first we tested this, the distribution of infinite axis trajectories, the width, and the C elegans. And we fit parameters of the environment, including prior. And then using those fitted parameters, one can predict the cumulative distribution of the time with which they leave. So you fit parameters here and use the same parameters to predict the time. The distribution of the duration of the local search. So that's one test on the distribution level. And and then we will test, yes? Is it not so? Okay.
I have to admit, I'm not exactly sure which distance you're measuring in the left.
This is millimeters.
No, that's okay. That wasn't the question. So this is the distance that they've traveled from the center, or the
The distribution of the from their initial, they are dropped off, and
maybe position would be more, or well, I guess it's you're only taking
distance,
the radial distance.
Yeah. Right. So you know, in fact, there are some experimental details such as the worm is transferred from food to another plate, and then from that plate, to get them cleaned up from bacteria, then they transfer it to a third plate.
And how much fitting is involved on the left? I mean, are you?
Well, there is some fitting. So one is the probability, width of the probability distribution. That's the main parameter.
But presumably, sorry, now I'm confused. But I mean, these are relatively featureless distributions, so if I get to adjust the width, they'll look similar.
Yeah, so this one, I agree that this is not a sufficient test, but once you fit this parameter, you use this parameter, and then you no longer fit it to adjust this second parameter, which is the distribution of times. And, you know.
And I should think of the thing on the left as the prior that the worm has
Not necessarily the prior.
The distribution of positions that he actually takes up, right?
Yes. So this is the distribution of positions during the local search. There will be other evidence.
So the parameter that you're fitting is
the width. The main parameter is the width.
And that's the width of the prior distribution.
The width of the prior distribution. So I will show you other evidence. So this is not the only evidence. Yes.
How do you define local search in this model?
So, yes, I know we talked about it. So, in the model, it's easy because there is really an abrupt transition. And in the data, I don't think I have a slide here, but Adam fit a two-state Markov model. And then that would determine. Yeah, so I know there is... as we discussed over lunch, there might be a more broader transition between the local and global search, but that's how this was estimated. So one can also say that because the duration is 15 minutes in some of the studies, we just take the number of reorientations during the 15 minutes.
Yeah. Have you tried plotting the probability distribution on a log scale?
Yes, and what is interesting about it is that it's not Gaussian.
Okay,
and
which one?
Both of them. Both of them are not Gaussian, so they have long tails. They have all the features of the natural scenes statistics. And I thought it was interesting, but maybe not interesting enough but to include in the talk. But so I didn't know what to do with it. So it is not Gaussian.
But do the tails for the blue and the red coincide?
Or? Well, presumably, I don't remember exactly for this particular graph, but there will be other data if this is not convincing enough. So there were some. So one prediction that we wanted to address is the difference with chemotaxis. The reason is that both, if we think about what happens, they were on the large order and concentration, then they experience a zero order concentration. So the chemotaxis prediction will also be that they will turn a lot, and then the number of turns should decrease. So there was two pieces of evidence that I will present that the chemotaxis is not convincing enough for this case. One of them is this, is that if it is adaptation to local change in the concentration, so then this is a series of curves, and they have one parameter, time, and this is the real data. And you can either match the initial slope or the final slope, but a single adaptive process cannot match both the more gradual decrease in the turning rate than the exponential function. So that's one evidence against chemotaxis. But more strikingly for me was this observation, is that what happens if we have the same patch of food, but diluted, the same patch of droplet, but diluted 10 times. So in the chemotaxis, I would expect that the number of turns would be affected by this manipulation. And it isn't in the infotaxis calculation because it's only based on the probability distribution. So to me, that was the most... a convincing part. Yes.
Can you explain that? Why would that be? Why would chemotaxis? I mean, it depends on the model of chemotaxis that you have, right? What? I mean, you can have a model that depends on the relative variation of food concentration for a certain distance.
Yes.
And that will be unaffected by a change, a global change in concentration.
It will be because the measurement is over time. So if I go from, say, concentration 1 to concentration 0, that's one gradient. And if I go from the concentration 0.1 to concentration 0, that's a different relative change.
Adaptation 1, you can avoid the gradient in respect to the level, so you can estimate gradients.
So suppose the
if you were perfectly sensitive to derivatives of the logarithm of the concentration, then you'd evade this test.
Yeah.
I don't believe anybody's actually perfectly sensitive. I mean, people say that, but actually, if you look at the data, it doesn't look like that. So
especially at low concentrations.
Yes, right.
Matthew, can you come in?
On like sensitivity to derivative?
Yeah. Of the logarithm?
Yeah, well, it's more like that. Exactly. Logarithm may play a role. What we found is that there's slope detection, but you also have memory that plays a role at the level of the olfactory sensory neuron. But that's for flies, so I don't know if you find its evidence.
Well, at least that's the model that I had, that if it is the number of turns is proportional to a change in the concentration, then I thought that would be. Yeah.
Was there any test to see whether the food was diluted sufficiently so that the worm was eating less? Because typically, the amount of food that's given to a worm is in excess. So when you give lower concentrations, the worm's still pumping at the same rate because there's so much food. So you have to give a really, really, really diluted amount of food for the pumping rate to drop. So another possibility is that the worm, maybe it isn't sufficient enough to really be perceived as diluted. Like if you have 100 hamburgers or 50 hamburgers,
well, I mean, they are sensitive, so maybe I will show a third piece of evidence. We see the difference with the patch size. So would that help?
With patch size, they frequently leave the food, so that's a huge difference. They stick out, pumping stops because there's no food there, and they come back in. And so with the size of the patch, that's different because now you're increasing the likelihood they'll experience no food.
I will show some evidence where we do track where they are in the patch, but your question is that if it is diluted enough.
Yeah, can you go at some point? I imagine dilution gets down to a point where you do see a difference in the orientations.
Well, that's an experimental possibility.
Okay.
So only try 10 times dilution.
Yeah, so you're talking about a model associated with chemotaxis, but there's more than chemotaxis here. So in Einstein, it's like they're also feeding, so it's internal state dependent with chemotaxis.
Yes, so there is dependence on the internal state. There is also dependence on the type of the bacteria that they eat. And I think it all is, so that's interact. I will show you that interacts with, say, probability distribution. It affects how long they search for food.
Okay, but I don't fully understand, like, how you may draw any conclusion from this graph, because it has to do with their feeding more than concentration of the chemical that they're sensing, I suppose. Or you don't know which effects is actually leading to potential change in reorientation rate.
Can you rephrase this question?
I've not fully understood the assumption that you were having here. So if you're using a chemotaxis model, you're diluting the order, and so you're rolling out a chemotaxis model based on the prediction. But what are the predictions here? So you have less food, you have less order, less chemical, and therefore you expect to have less reorientation rate? Is that
yes?
Okay, but I'm not entirely sure why you wouldn't have that, but on top of it, I think the fact that the food, like what they're sitting on, would be more or less nutritive is probably going to also affect like how much they're going to reorient, right? So it's more than chemotaxis here. It seems to be like a much larger problem.
Well, I would like to get away from the discussion of food because I don't quite understand why it's relative on the short term, on this short term discussion. So it's not like they're it's not that they're starving that prevents them from changes in the reorientation. But, I mean, to my mind, I thought that you have large concentration and you experience large gradient. So, you know, going back to maybe, you know, the way I was thinking about it is that if the concentration is at 1, and even though I'm adapted to it, and then the concentration is at 0, that's a change of, even in relative terms, that's a change of 1. Isn't that true? And then if, so you think if it is perfectly adapted to logarithm, then going to 0 is the same thing as...
Zero is special, right? I would prefer, at least from my understanding of what you're saying, I would feel better if you showed us the positive evidence that the theory agrees with.
Well, the positive,
and then we could have a discussion about whether it's something else. But
and then we discuss at the end.
So, I mean, you know, the positive evidence was once that it matches the probability distribution. Then the other evidence, you know, to my mind, this was that it depends on the probability distribution. So this is the size of the drop. So the size of the drop is proportional to the probability, to the width of the prior, and the number orientation increases. And then if it is diluted, then there is no difference in the reorientation. So that was my evidence. Then we will talk a little bit about variations, about how they, even though they are isogenic animals, how they track food. You know, variations in their behavior as a function of their precise position on the patch. So maybe that will help addressing the questions with shape of the patch. Is that okay? So then going back to, so, and I agree that potentially it's, I had a simpler model than the chemotaxis. Chemotaxis can be a complicated model, but the question was, how can this be implemented neurally? And what I was going to suggest is that, as I mentioned, that during the search, we can track, we can view this search as a two alternative choice model. So in fact, track the log probability that the source is elsewhere. And it turns out that when this probability, when the log of the probability is 0, so when the probability that the source is elsewhere hits 1, this is when they leave. And so now one can solve these trajectories for different widths of the prior. And because this is effectively a drift diffusion model, one can approximate it in a simple neural circuit with a few neurons, and I will show you how. So even though it's a complicated, so in other words, one can, I think, approximate this decision-making and the infotaxis calculation, but just with a drift diffusion model, and it matches the infotaxis calculation. So that's my explanation for how they can do it. Is that okay? Are there any questions so far? So one can check how it scales by the prior widths. For example, this is different cumulative probability of the search duration time as a function of the number of steps, and it scales nearly perfectly by the width of the prior distribution. So it also scales by the diffusion lengths. So in other words, one can approximate this infotaxis calculation with effectively three neurons. A sensory neuron that will initiate the search, like trigger the local search. There is some evidence accumulation neuron. And then there is another neuron that potentially would implement, kind of set the rate of the accumulation, and that can be dopamine, but it also modulates, takes the effects of the prior into account, takes the effect of how motivated, whether it's a tasty bacteria or not, and So then that's kind of a simple model how one can approximate the infinite axis calculation. In this case, was a few neurons and a few parameters. So now I cannot adapt here to very complicated probability distributions, but we can adapt. We can search adapt to changes in, say, the width of the prior, so one parameter of the distribution. I see more questions. Are there more questions?
And the evidence is the evidence for the presence of the source elsewhere.
Say it again.
So when you say evidence accumulation, is evidence.
So the idea is that I don't really need to compute the probability. I just need to know for how long to search. And so I do random search, so I can approximate the infinite axis calculation by doing a random search for a given amount of time. And if I didn't find it, so, and then one can think of it more broadly, how we can search for food. You say, well, I think the food is somewhere in this neighborhood. You search for it for a given amount of time, and that depends on, there is a feedback from the gut, and how hungry the animal is, how tasty the bacteria, what's the prior about, how big is the patch should be. And if it is not there, then you leave to go somewhere else.
Right,
so
the neural network that you mentioned is calculating
the neural network?
You mentioned that this little neural network that you have, what kind of evidence is calculating? You have this evidence.
So it doesn't compute, it's just a timer. So one neuron to trigger the search, and then, that's the model. So it doesn't really have, my thought is that it doesn't really need to compute probability distributions and how they're updated.
But that is not just counting time, right? Because all these trajectories, they end up at different times. So I assume this is calculating evidence for the presence of the food in the local area.
Yes.
Somehow.
Yes, but I think that it just counting time with different slope, with the slope that is learned, with the slope that is a learned parameter.
I think you just answered my question. So how does it get the drift direction? It learns over time.
Yeah, so this one, so I will discuss how they learn this. So this is.
One more question. So, are your factory information, or is this combined to define the drift? So, you will have internal state, so that's like dopaminergic.
Yeah, so there is, there is actually more evidence. So, there is a paper by. There's a biology paper that assigns, even though I said, for example, they actually tested, and I will show you some evidence, but I'm not that qualified to speak about, but they actually did experiments to determine that the dopamine is necessary, that CREB is necessary in what neuron, and so on. So one can make a concrete link with the underlying circuitry. So the thought is that there is a sensory neuron that is sensitive to the change in the order concentration. So to my mind, that begins the search. And then if that neuron is not activated or turned off, there's no positive order detection, then it can integrate for some time. And the time is determined by signaling from other dopamine neurons. Does that sound reasonable?
Yes, except that I expect that those changes at the level of the sensory input will be on a time scale that's much shorter than what will happen with the feedback related to feeding. Like, I think that will happen over several minutes, probably, whereas like those changes in concentration while the worm is moving on the patch will happen on time scale of seconds. So
this one is in time of scale of seconds. The initiation, the initiation is fast, the local search is about 15 minutes, and the modulation by dopamine, so this is what the data I will show you in a moment, is about, on this time scale, of 30 minutes. So, So the way these experiments were done is that one can actually image the distribution of bacteria on a plate. And it turns out it's not a Gaussian, but more of a ring. And it has sharp peaks, sharp edges. And one can monitor the worm, specific worms, about how they crawled around that patch. And then the next question was, can we take this trajectory and predict variation in animals in the number of turns that the animal makes? So the idea is that they are isogenic animals, but they have different past sensory experiences. And the claim is that one can explain the variation in the number of turns that they make once they're off food based on their prior history. So what we tested a number of features of this trajectory, and what we settled was important was the number of times they've been on this edge, and maybe that's related to this question that their nose goes back and forth across the edge, and that's a salient event. So we did a little bit of dimensionality reduction using in the style of reverse correlation, where we take the times that the animal's been on the lawn as input and the number of turns that they made when they're off food as output, and we find a kernel using a method that we developed, and that's basically the kernel that is obtained. So one can analyze it. There has a number of interesting features. One of them is that immediate 5 minutes prior to the removal of food have no impact on the behavior, which to my experimental colleague suggested that you need protein synthesis. Then the last 30 minutes are important, and then the time after 30 minutes is not important. So we can test those predictions, but also see how well this model accounts for the data. Yes?
Coefficients are multiplied by what?
So this is in arbitrary, kind of arbitrary units.
But we are multiplied by some history, and what is it?
So like you take the number of history that the animal has been on the edge of the lawn.
Okay.
And this is the weighting kernel.
Or just a binary variable of being conventional.
Yes, so this is a binary variable. Then it convolved with this filter, and then the pass-through nonlinearity. So it's a logistic model, and that's a prediction for the number of turns when they're off food. And that turns out to have high correlation between the number of predicted number of reorientations and observed number of reorientations. Again, over 15 minutes after they removed for food. So there's a couple of data points. So for example, this worm right here, here's its trajectory. It's been on the edge very little. And then there's another one that is has been on the edge a lot. And one can relate this, how much time they've been on the edge, even though we try to put this as an identical drop, but how often they have been on the edge is their measurement of how the ratio of circumference to the volume. So if they're on the edge more, then it's kind of like they experience a smaller patch, and then there is a smaller number of reorientations. And this is the other point where they think they experience a bigger patch, so they experience more orientations. So that's trying to go beyond the average predictions into account for variability in individual neuron behavior. And one can also test, and the final examination was to test these profiles of this learning kernel. And so they can be on the big patch, and then from the big patch they go to another big patch, or they go from the big patch to a small patch, and then on the big patch. So if that happens, if they're on the small patch for only 5 minutes, then they behave as if that didn't happen, so as if they've been on the large patch all the time. if they've been on this small patch for 15 and 30 minutes or more, then they behaved as if they forgot about the large patch. So it shows that they can learn aspects of the probability distributions, and even though they're small and have 300 neurons. I hope that collectively answers some of the questions about modulations and timescales. Let's see. I still have some time for my second part. This is some of the evidence that we have Bayesian search strategies that account from transition to local search in C. elegans. We see that number orientations depends on the width of the prior distribution, is independent of the order and concentration. And then one can explain some fraction of future behavior in isogenic animals based on their prior sensory experience. Any questions before I talk about olfactory space? Yes.
So you have shown that you assume prior to be Gaussian, but it's a little bit wider. So I'm wondering if it can be accounted for by bacteria procreation. Like, if you just imagine that we diffuse, you would have a Gaussian solution to diffusion equation. But
right. It's a good question, except the bacteria is dead in this case.
Okay.
So I didn't mention that the bacteria has been killed.
Sorry,
because they would otherwise disperse, yes.
I know a slightly different thing there. Like, evolutionary bacteria probably is used to, like, natural patches in which we would probably procreate, and maybe that's why it has a prior of wider distribution. Could it be the case?
You think that there is a certain patch that they expect?
Yep.
It actually is true. So one can remove dopamine from neurons, from the C. elegans, and they have a default patch size that they go for without learning. And I forget whether it's a large patch or a small patch.
So it sounds like it can be modeled, right?
What?
So it sounds like it could be modeled.
Modeled?
Just the diffusion equation with supply diffusions.
So you think one can ask whether the default size of the patch corresponds to a typical bacteria size in
like
rotten apples or something. Yes, I haven't thought about it, but I asked people about what's the natural distribution. They say, well, I don't know. I think it's worth thinking about it.
I'm sorry, I'm still a little bit confused about the setup, trying to reconcile the second part of the talk with the first. So there are two length scales, right? One is the diameter of the bacterial patch, and the other is the range in which the worm expects that patch to be.
No. Well, yes, but not in this model. So in some of the data that I'm not showing, they also tried to make more complicated patches where it was a big patch, and inside of the big patch there was little patches. So one can get, you know, very complicated. So in this model, the assumption is that there's only a certain patch size, that's only one, and there's only one length scale. Maybe there is a ratio of length scale between this sigma and the size of the arena. Maybe that's the question. Is that your question? That there's a ratio of the sigma to the size of the arena, and that's correct. So we normalize sigma by the in relative terms.
Well, the reason I'm asking is that the worm trajectory also has kind of two time scales, length scales. One is the total area to be explored, and the other one is how densely it has to be explored.
So that how, seems, yes,
in
it's
my
true.
Mind, that would presumably map on the
yes,
two
so,
scales.
Yes,
the
it prior. Is true. So,
but I.
Yes, so I glanced over it, so I will show you some data. So the way this this works, there are two. One length scale is the prior width, and the other length scale, which I glanced over, is a diffusion length. So this is how it determines the resolution with which how finely it needs to be explored. And these combine, so they're not two independent parameters.
How does the worm know? Learning those, or it's
yes,
hardwired?
Yes, so I think it is learning. It's learning one parameter. It can learn one parameter, and that's the evidence that if you switch from a big patch to a small patch, then they can learn, and they have a default size for the patch. So it is learning, and it can learn. So that's this evidence.
So the patch, sorry, then maybe I don't understand the word. So the patch is what? It's the width of the bacterial spot, or it's the range of where the worm expects it to be? What's the patch?
The patch is the ratio of the width to, say, our plate. So in units of the plate, the width of the patch. So you have a big patch or a small patch. Is that okay? I think that maybe I should move on because there is a second part to my talk, and I'm sure there are lots of questions for that part. Mm-hmm. Is that okay? I mean, we can talk about it, but I think there is a ratio of length scales. So the second part is very new, and it's following up on the work by Dima Rindberg and Alex Kulakov, but also other labs, as I will mention. And it was a topic of the discussion last time I was at KITP. We discussed about the dimensionality of the olfactory space. So in some ways, it's a progress report on those discussions. So the idea is that unlike the space of visual space, which is continuous, the orders are discrete, and how can we put them on a map? And what I would like to say is that, to be slightly provocative, I want to take us back to how species were classified before Darwin and argue, so the way we classify orders is similar to how species were classified before Darwin. So there was a kind of, one can look at the overlap between species by the overlap in their properties. So we have a descriptors, and if the descriptors match more, then there was these sets of overlapping circles by how one can classify species. And you know, you classify orders based on their properties, descriptors, many descriptors. So I think one can have a map that goes from descriptors to a continuous map. So in order to do that, I might be missing some slides, but So the way we would like to know the topological space of orders, presumably there is a nonlinear space, and it's hard to do nonlinear dimensionality reduction. So one can help by figuring out generally the geometry of the space first, and then once we know the geometry, we can use various fitting techniques to find parameters of the geometry. So to find the overall features of the geometry, we followed up on the approach that was put forward by Vladimir Itzkov and Karina Kurta on topological methods. So their idea is that we are going to classify orders not based on their chemical structure, but based on how correlated they are in the natural environment, and perhaps that builds on Dimitri's talks about similarity. So if I have different orders here, And across various environments, this will be a correlation structure. And this is their matrix. So one can threshold this matrix at different levels. And first, when you threshold it, there's only one entry that is most correlated. And that corresponds, the corresponding graph connects two most correlated orders. And then you lower the threshold, and gradually more orders get connected. And finally, they're all fully connected. So one can evaluate progression, the structure of this correlation matrix with a number of cycles. And as we connect graph in generally, the cycles will appear like here. They will persist, and then they will disappear when they're fully filled. So the measure that they proposed in their paper is the Betti curves. So it's the number of cycles as a function of the edge of the density, how filled these curves are. And then we talked about we can have holes in one dimension, such as here, or in two dimensions, such as a sphere, or in three dimensions. So one can evaluate this graph according to these topological methods. So this is what we will do. We have a set of orders in the natural environment, and we compute how correlated they are. We pass them through this topological technique. And what actually what Vladimir and Karina did was they showed that this procedure is sensitive to the presence of the geometric structure in the data. So they looked at the hippocampus data, but we're going to look at something else. So they showed that if you have randomly shuffled data, then the Betti curves increase, the peaks of the Betti curves increase with orders. And if you have geometric Betti curves, think about like receptive fields plotted in some Euclidean space, then the peaks will decrease. So one can distinguish the presence of the geometric structure using this construction. And of course, advantage of the topological methods is that they're invariant to one nonlinear transformations of the data because we are cutting the order correlation matrix, rank ordering it. So it doesn't matter if it is nonlinearly transformed. So our approach will be to follow up on this observation number one, but also consider other spaces. And there are, of course, adducations. It's a different perceptual space, so we will talk about statistics of orders in the natural environment. But one can also build on the perceptual space. So this is a figure from Alex and Dima's paper here, which showed that the perceptual space is curved, but also from Noam Sobel's data. And they didn't talk about the curvature, but if you look at the data, it does look curved. And, you know, here it's modeled as a potato chip, and here it also like, looks like a hyperbola. So that's one of the hints that we will take to check the for the presence of the, whether the space is hyperbolic. So there's another reason to expect, and that goes back to the species analogy, that there is a way to go from descriptor overlap space to the hyperbolic space. So it turns out if I can represent the data in this way, I have a big cluster and inside of it smaller clusters and inside of it even smaller clusters. So I can take this construction and go back to the network, to hierarchical network. So the way it's done is following. I take coordinates of these circles, and this is x and y. And the size of the circle is a z direction. So I can go from a set of descriptors to a hierarchical tree-like network. So why is this important? Because once I have a hierarchical tree-like networks, they generally approximate hyperbolic spaces. So this is a projection of the one-dimensional tree. So, well, it's in two dimensions, so z and x. And one can view it as an approximation to this more discrete space, discretized space, and it's actually a model by the Poincaré half plane. So there is a connection between, we know that, yes?
Can I just make a comment? I mean, yes. I really like the species analogy, but I just want to make this comment before anybody else does.
Okay.
So the species analogy is actually very well based in the origin of species, right? Species the topology of the T respects the original species, which are created by duplication, right? So therefore, I mean, it actually reflects the biology. Whereas, like, creation of molecules doesn't involve a single molecule. They usually are created by, you know, merging
two or three
molecules.
I can actually have an answer
so
to that.
They have to do some loops. So,
okay,
I really like
I have two comments to this. First of all, it turns out that you can have loops here and still have an approximate hyperbolic space. So it doesn't have to be a strict tree life. And the second one, we are not talking about the creation of molecules. The reason why I'm pursuing this approach is that we believe in the similarity of the input spaces. And I believe that the reason I use smell is when I smell food and it smells bad, I'm using a correlation that a certain chemical is associated with certain bacteria, and maybe I shouldn't eat that food. So the way we're going to classify orders is based on correlations. And it's not the molecular structure of the orders of how they're produced, but how they are produced by hierarchical biochemical networks. So to my mind, there is a reason to expect that classifying, so the way they will be put on a tree is from the biochemical networks. That's my answer. that's probably as close as we can get. Yeah.
I'm sorry, just for non-specialists. So what space is this tree in? I mean, what are the nodes?
This is extract. So so X and Y, that's, you know, pure mathematics.
No, but I'm trying to make a connection. So, if this is not important to understand the rest of the talk, you can just blow me off. But I've been lost the last few slides, so...
So I'm trying to give a background. I mean, it doesn't have to be... maybe I can recover, I can get you back on the next slide, but I was just trying to motivate the fact why I'm looking for hyperbolic spaces in the natural olfactory environment. You know, ultimately I will show you data, and then that's what happens, but I'm just giving you my motivation for why I'm looking for hyperbolic spaces in the space of natural orders.
For me to completely understand, so how do you define hyperbolic space?
It's a hyperbolic space with a negative curvature.
And why is it? I don't really understand the figure. I'm sorry about this.
So the hyperbolic space is has many projections, many representations. So we can use Poincaré half plane is one way. So, if you have a hyperbolic, there are many ways to represent a hyperbolic space. There are none are perfect, but basically, the way I think about it is that the density of states increases exponentially towards the boundary.
So, Katiana, for me to, I'm sorry if I don't mean to get, but how do you produce the red line there?
Like, this one?
Yeah. Why does it look like a...
I didn't talk about it. So this is a geodesic point between two points, A and B. And there are two geodesics. One of them is a discrete version based... the semicircle is a geodesic in the Poincaré half plane. This discrete version goes between centers of the squares. You see, so it goes from here to the neighboring part, from here, here, here. And, this is how you actually define distance in trees. So what's the distance between B4 and B7? I have to go up and down, right?
Okay, so take all the leaves of the tree, and then you find shortest paths between pairs of them.
So that's the idea that if you talk about the leaves of the tree, then their shortest path will be curved. It's not going to be, this way you have to go up the tree and down. So that's the shortest path, and that's the approximation for the hyperbolic space.
Oh, so every edge is like same length, right?
Say it again.
Every edge is same length. Okay.
So that's my motivation. Here's the data. So we looked at the data set from strawberries. It's about 80 monomolecular orders and about 80 different species of strawberries. It's from food industry. They are trying to figure out what's the best and most tastiest strawberry one can make. And so then we are going to use the BETI technique from Vladimir Itzkov et al. And so we are going to...
So the raw data are that they measured the concentrations of 81 molecules...
Across 80 different, approximately 80 different strawberries. Well, different strawberry species.
And so you compute using the correlation matrix among all these things, and you use that as the beginning of the...
At the beginning, and then we evaluate this correlation matrix using BETI curves.
It's the correlation between orders or between species?
Between orders. Across samples, across species, across samples. So, the data is in the dashed line. And the best fit using the hyperbolic space here is in the solid line. And the best fit using Euclidean line, Euclidean space is here. So this is, and one can see that the Euclidean space fits much worse than the hyperbolic space. Yes.
So why do you want to fit this? I mean, like, so you're measuring the BETI? I just don't know what it tells you.
So I'm trying to figure out what space is consistent with the observed correlation matrices.
So you have some measure of the topology.
Yeah, so it's a way to help me out with nonlinear dimensionality reduction.
But really you want to go back to the geometry. I mean,
Going to go back to geometry, but that's...
All right, the space that you start with is a space whose the coordinates are the concentrations of molecules, or the coordinates are the names of molecules. So is the topology...
Names of molecules, but they're also concentrations. So the space is names of molecules, and the distance between two molecules is how correlated they are across samples.
So the space is the vectors.
So the space is discrete to start out with, then?
Yeah. The space is discrete.
There's a finite number of components, but they change continuously in concentration.
Yes.
So it's not discrete. And there's a discrete number of components, like a vector. Each one of the species of...
So it's 80-dimensional. Say it's 80-dimensional because we measured 80 components.
Wait, so the original space is a vector space where each component is the concentration of a given molecule in a particular species?
Yeah, that's the starting measurement, yes.
Okay, and so... For each molecule, you have a vector where each component represents its concentration of that molecule in 80 species.
Yes.
That's the space with which you start.
Yes.
How many molecules are measured?
80. Well, approximately 80. The difference between different... I will talk about different data sets. I will talk about
so
four different data sets.
Molecules and 80 species, but I shouldn't have questions. Can you just explain a little bit? So hyperbolic, you talked about trees, and of course the thing about trees, they don't have loops, and they don't have cycles. Now we're counting cycles and what?
The hyperbolic was just a motivation. The trees can have loops in order to be approximated by hyperbolic spaces. And then, how can I put this? The idea is that suppose I have points on the hyperboloid, and then I measure distances between these points. And from these distances, I generate a correlation matrix. And then I say, well, how does this correlation matrix behave under this topological construction? Then we have experimental correlation matrix. And we see how does it behave under this topological construction.
So another question is, on this slide, you made the point that so the evidence of structure is non-monotonicity of the three-colored curve.
Yes.
And then you fit your strawberry data to a couple models, but how about fitting it to randomly shuffled curves?
It is different from the random shuffle data. Well, I will show you. The random shuffle increases too fast in terms of the peak compared to the data. So it is true that the hyperbolic model has one extra parameter, which is the curvature of the space compared to Euclidean's. For Euclidean models, the parameter is the dimensionality of the space, and in the hyperbolic model we have dimensionality of the space and its curvature. So there's one more parameter. Yes.
The ends of this tree is with the clusters of molecules. Do they have any chemical similarity at all?
So. Yes. So it turns out that. After I show you data across various species of molecules, they're not particularly clustered by the chemical similarity. In the resultant space, the molecules are correlated and they belong to groups. I will show you three slides that are very similar to this, and after that I will show you the slide about chemical groups. So this was a strawberry data set, and then it turns out there's more data sets. There is a blueberry data set, and it's accounted by the same parameters, same curvature, and again, the hyperbolic space fits. So yes, there are deviations, but one can talk about statistics. In this case, we evaluate statistics by the integral of the Betti curve to show that the data, which is in black triangles, matches the variation from different samples of the space, of the model hyperbolic space. And it doesn't, one can exclude Euclidean data based on statistics. So not just looking at the curves, but one can see the deviations in here. There's also a tomato data set, and there's a mouse urine data set. If we shuffle the data, then they become consistent with the random matrix. So that's the one that we did. And we know that we actually include a little bit of noise. So and the optimal amount of noise is small. So that's why I think it's inconsistent with the randomly shuffled data, with random. So now I'm going to talk a little bit. My slide about olfactory groups is coming, but I'll talk about how these molecules. So this is how these molecules were positioned within this hyperbolic space. So now we think we found the space. We think it's hyperbolic.
Sorry, Tatiana. Let me just be sure I understand. What you would like to do is to give these discrete molecules
positions.
Have names. Start. You want to give them coordinates
In
some space on which you can put a metric. And
that's right.
And your criterion is sort of in a almost like in multidimensional scaling or something.
Exactly.
You want, or for that matter,
DSME.
Exactly. Right, whatever. You want the correlation of the concentrations to be a function of distance in this space.
Right.
Okay. So I don't need to think about Betti curves. I can think of what I want
right.
is to find the problem
right.
you're trying to solve. I mean that's a path to finding this and okay.
Yeah.
So in some sense, if you showed me a graph said, look, I found a space and I write the metric of the space.
That's right.
And I write the coordinates
yes.
and now I compute the geodesic distance between
that's right.
points. And I make a scatter plot of the distance
that's
between
right.
points and the correlations, and there should be some shape to the curve.
Yes, there is a stronger correlation that if we did all of this, and then If you do it in the hyperbolic coordinates, there's a better match than in the, there's a stronger correlation than in the.
So is there a way of, is there a way of formulating?
So this is multidimensional scaling.
Yeah.
Onto the hyperbolic space.
Okay.
So, and then one can see how they're, these are individual order molecules. And it turns out that, as I mentioned, the hyperbolic spaces can be visualized in different ways. One of them is this half plane. The other one is the Poincaré sphere. And it turns out that natural order molecules all cluster near the edge of the sphere. So we can just use them as a sphere. So even though it's hyperbolic space, but because they come out to be just near the edge of it, so these are individual molecules that have names, and they, in this fitted space, they cover it approximately uniformly.
What's the dimensionality of the hyperbolic?
Three. Turns out three was the best fit. So, and then these are... So maybe I should skip some of the details because I only have a few minutes left. But roughly speaking, they are uniform. We found axes in this space of building up on the previous work. There's a like a pleasantness axis. There are other axes associated with acidity and molecular boiling point. But here is a slide that I did want to show in terms of different groups. And yeah, there is some clustering by the groups, but also different elements can be mapped next to each other. I hope that was meant as an answer to your question. So this is how the.
I mean, when one possibility is that you know, odors are notoriously susceptible to oxidation, and so perhaps one reason why you have trees is because they always oxidate to species from different chemicals. Now to explain why you have a tree-like structure, because you have all the oxidation happening, so you have all these oxidation products. And so each end of the tree would have a mixture of alcohols, esters and stuff, based upon the different oxidation levels of each molecule. And that might explain why you have this tree-like structure. And that's sort of tied to a previous comment about, you know, that there is, a, I guess it's not a biological view, but it's a chemical tree showing the progression of oxidation. Because that's why we add antioxidants to all these fruits and or processed fruit and processed foods is to prevent this oxidation, to prevent this diversification of the chemical content of the food. So it might be interesting to look at the ends of the trees, and that would explain why you have this geometry. And perhaps we've evolved to
So what we see is thank you for your comment. But basically, what we find is that the molecules that are measured can be mapped onto kind of correspond to the leaves of the tree, and they can be mapped onto a surface. And that's a little different with perception, where we find a filled hyperbolic space. But I think maybe I should, since I have till 10:15, so I can stop, just say that we did the same thing with perceptual data set. And in this case, the difference with natural orders was that the orders from the Drevnik's data set clustered on one side of the space, which suggests that there are more orders to be tested. And then the distribution of radii was not now, it was also a three-dimensional hyperbolic space, but the distribution of orders was not at the edge of the sphere, but was more filled than compared to natural orders. So I think that's... I can stop here, but basically we see that there are four different natural order sets that are actually described by the same curved space with the same curvature, same parameters, and the perceptual space is similar curved, but it's also filled. And because once we have these coordinates in natural order space, and there is a pleasantness value for that people measured for strawberries and tomatoes, then one can predict how well one pleasant will be based on the two other coordinates, which in that case we tried acidity and molecular boiling point, but there may be others. So thank you for your attention. I will thank my group and the two collaborations. The first part was with Srikant Chalasani on C. elegans, and the second part was Brian Smith at Arizona State University.
So you consider the dimensionality of the order space with respect to kind of how this order is correlated in the environment, I mean, how they appear in fruits. But how do you think it can be used to calculate the dimensionality in the actual neural encoding or perceptual encoding?
Well, perceptual, yes. But neural is a separate question, and I know a number of groups are working on it, including Dima and so on. So neural we haven't looked, but perception is the part that I glanced over. It was in the DriveNICS data set, and so again, each order tested is evaluated in terms of descriptors, and there we take the difference in the descriptor values as a distance between different orders, and then we evaluate with this topology, but also with MDS, and one can sort of, this was a reproduction between data and hyperbolic MDS, and the Euclidean doesn't fit, so this is kind of the data here showing that Euclidean space doesn't fit, but That's the part that was too fast, given the time constraint. But I think one can do it for perception. In principle, one could do it for the neural responses, but we haven't done it.
So again, I'm trying to understand it a little bit. So let's leave perception out of it for the moment. The things that whose coordinates you're finding are not odors, they're molecules, right?
Yes.
And so
when I can also do odors.
Oh, I know, but in this case you're doing each point is a molecular component of something that I might smell.
That's right.
And you're saying that they should be close to each other in this space because in the real world their concentrations co-vary. So you might say, well, they're close to each other. So, for example, if I interchange the one for the other, it might not make much difference because in the real world they tend to go together anyway. So, if I think about the path from one molecule to another, are there situations in which there's another molecule? So the problem with the discreteness of molecules, right, is that it's hard to find things in between. So.
Well,
can you now show me, for instance, that, okay, here's a molecule and here's a nearby molecule. Could you draw the molecule and say there ought to be something in between and go,
no,
make, somebody
there,
will make it?
I don't think there ought to be, but I can interpolate using mixtures of molecules. So sometimes.
Well, but if you're giving the molecules.
Each molecule is an axis and the kind of the concentration.
Oh, well, but that's a different space, right? So here the
yeah, so actually
space,
yeah,
each molecule is a point.
Yeah, so but we also draw points that correspond to linear combinations of molecules based on their axes. Each molecule is a point, but I think I can still interpolate between them. So each molecule is an axis.
But it's not necessarily the case that in this space the linear combination would be interpolated between those two molecules, right?
I mean, there's two different questions, right? One is, can I put the names of molecules into a continuous space in which distance means something?
Okay.
And the other is, can I put a metric on the vector space of concentrations of all these molecules that corresponds, for instance, to their perceptual, right, there, you know, so that short distances corresponds to perceptual similarity. There's some hypothesis that might relate these two. Perceptual similarity is related to correlation in the natural world, and you know, something like that might work. But I'm not seeing it yet, right?
But I would say these are two separate questions. If we can leave perception for now, I would still argue that if you have two molecules, these are two points, and I interpolate between them by varying the concentration. It's like a non-orthogonal basis.
No, but if I have two wavelengths of light, I can do two things, right? I can make intermediate wavelengths,
That's right.
I can make a mixture of the two.
That's right.
And the fact that we see them as the same is a fact about our visual system. It's not true about a spectrometer.
Right.
So
that's true, yes.
Bill, can I just, so you have pixels on the screen. They're the screen. Does it bother you that there's no pixels in between? Like if you look at that screen, there's a bunch of discrete pixels.
Yeah, but I believe there's an underlying continuous space.
Right, but there's none. There are pixels. Like you look at, I mean, there's nothing in between. Does it bother you?
I think the same a little bit off the screen. continuous space.
Well, so that's the issue.
No, I'm asking. So when I, but remember, I didn't have to put these in this space, right? So if I put the points if I take the discrete names of things and put them, if I put them on a tree, then I've given you a structure which embodies the discreteness explicitly. If I put them in a continuous space, such that distance in that space is rather similar to what it would have been on the tree, then the statement that there are points in a continuous space leads you to ask whether there are things in between, right?
But there might not be. There are no. So suppose there are no. The space is really discrete, but we can work with it in a continuous
then
manner.
Then I'm not sure I know what the, is it, okay. I'm not sure I understand what the...
Let's make it continue itself. That's the good.